So in his
inwards.
Final, he's facing inwards, yes. In his final all-night meditation, sitting under the Bodhi tree, on that full moon day in the month of Vaishakha, the Buddha is facing east. And through the night, you've got this sense of the moon passing overhead, and in a way, that movement of the moon representing the phases of his meditation. And then during the most difficult sides of that meditation, as we heard in the readings, it goes dark. And then the moon emerges again, and the emergence of the moon, the way it's described, the emergence of all the stars shining once again, sort of represents a great sense of relief, I think, in the Buddha's process. So imagine that you encountered this scene. I think it's very good to sort of try and put oneself there. Imagine that you got a bit lost in the forests in India, and you're wandering along at night looking for your bed and breakfast, and then you saw, under the full moon, this man sitting under a tree, very, very still, very quiet, in the moonlight, sitting on a heap of hay, which is what he used as his meditation cushion, very still, but inside there's this great turmoil going on. And you have every lingering doubt that he's got, every longing that he's got, every trace of hostility that's still there. It's flying at him. It's flying at him as the assaults of the army of Mara. So if you look at the picture on the back wall and you look carefully, you'll see the longings are the maidens dancing in the front, and then the army with its weapons of demons and monsters is around him. In the tree itself, so that you can see the attacks of the hosts of Mara there. And this is the way it's described in the poem I was using in the readings. Now that he'd defeated Mara's violence by his firmness and calm, the Bodhisattva, possessed of great skill in meditation, put himself into meditative absorption, intent on discerning both the ultimate reality of things and the final goal of existence. And after he'd gained complete mastery over all the degrees and kinds of meditative absorption, firstly, he remembered his life. He remembered thousands of births as though he was living them all over again. And when he'd recalled all his own births and deaths in all those various lives of his, then the sage, full of pity, turned his compassionate mind towards other living beings, and he thought to himself, again and again, they must leave the people they regard as their own. They must go on elsewhere, and that without ever stopping. Surely this world is unprotected and helpless. Like a wheel, it turns round and round. And this metaphor that Buddha used very early on is what became the Tibetan Wheel of Life, the sense of being trapped in wheel-like existence that is just always recurring, always happening over again. And he wanted to find ways of freeing himself and freeing other people from that wheel. Then the Bodhisattva turned his meditation to the real and essential nature of the world. Alas, living beings wear themselves out in vain. Over and over again, they're born, they age, they die, they pass on. What is more, greed and dark delusion obscure their sight, and they're blind from birth. Greatly apprehensive, they yet do not know how to get out of this great mass of difficulty. So that's the second watch of the night, when he's looking at other people. He's taking in the predicament of other beings. And then the third watch. When the great seer had comprehended the conditioned arising of events, then he'd achieved a correct knowledge of all there is to be known, and he stood out in the world as a Buddha. He passed through all the meditative absorptions. He quickly reached their highest point, and from the summit of the world downwards, he could detect no self anywhere. Like the fire, when its fuel is burnt up, he became tranquil. He'd reached perfection, and he thought to himself, this is the authentic path on which in the past so many great seers, who also knew all higher and all lower things, have travelled on to ultimate and real truth. Now I've obtained it. So it's you have the enlightenment, and you also have the knowledge of enlightenment. So the Buddha is said to have got to a point where he realised, yeah, this is it. This is enlightenment. I won't say very much about it, but I do find it very interesting what in that description at least, what the Buddha went through, the process the Buddha went through during that night, during the three watches of the night. And it seems to me, I hope I'm not being too interpretive here, but it seems to me the first watch is to do with self-knowledge. You know, he looked back over his own past. He became aware of his conditioning. He became aware of the processes, the experiences that had brought him to where he was at that moment. And you really, you've got to understand yourself. And sometimes I think it is valuable just to think about your life, to look back over your life. If you can remember previous lives as well, then great. But you know, most of us can't do that. But at least this life, look back, think about your childhood. What was that like? Think about your relationships. Think about your priorities, the things that you went for. And try to take those on board. Think about the things that you did, the things you got wrong, the things you got right. Maybe even sort of write a little bit about it. And I think this is really valuable, that process, which is represented by that first watch of the night, when the Buddha just looks back. He just looks back and he says, this is how I got to where I am now. Self-knowledge. You've got to sort of somehow, this Socrates thing, isn't it? Know thyself. It's the most important thing that a human being can do. But he doesn't stop there, because the second watch of the night, he broadens his understanding or his awareness. And he starts thinking of other people. And he realises, well, we've got a lot in common, me and other people, and we're also different as well. And he thinks back over his experience, over his knowledge of human nature, of the people he's known, his parents and his family and all the others, his friends and so on, the people he'd been practicing with for the last 6 years, all the meditations he's been doing. And he tried to come to a sense of what is it like to be a human being. He tried to come to an understanding of karma. He tried to come to an understanding of how it is that what people do and think and say actually creates their future life. Creates their future life within this life, that is. It creates their experience. Our experience is built up over the decisions we make and the paths that we choose. And he came to a very, very deep understanding of that. And of course, for his point of view, if you're going to be a spiritual teacher, you've got to have some sense of what makes other people tick. It's not enough just to understand yourself. And this compassionate element has always been fundamental in Buddhism, the sense that you've got to care, not just about yourself, but about others as well. And caring about others means being prepared to understand them. Understanding them means seeing this is the kind of things that, these are the mistakes people make, these are the things that work that people do. So that's the second watch of the night. Now the third watch of the night is much more difficult to talk about, because in a way this is a still more of a broadening, to have a sense of the whole of conditionality, of the whole of the web, the network of factors that mean that everything is connected together in all sorts of ways. And we can learn about the what modern people would call the scientific laws that connect things together. You can start to understand the way the human mind works. You can start to understand the way that the world works. You can understand physics and chemistry. You can understand sort of nations. You can understand history, all these different subjects. You can get a sense of the way things connect together. And one of the things that struck me in the reading was when he's looking over conditionality, he says, if I remember rightly, he says, it's not due to any God that this happens. And then he says, it's also not due to matter that it happens. And then he says, it's not just chance that it happens. And finally, he says, it's not due to a self that it happens. And this is in Buddha Ghosh's version, at least. So I hadn't quite, until we did the reading this afternoon, I hadn't quite tweaked on that. It's very interesting, that, isn't it? And he says, instead, it's due to this network of conditionality, which one can come to understand, the network of the way things fit together. Now, all the while, as he's going through this process of understanding, we've got the full moon. I just have that sense of the light of the moon just wheeling overhead, starting behind him and going down ahead of him. And I think of the dappled shadows in the moonlight under the tree. Also, if you remember, he's sitting near a river. So rather than the sound of traffic, what he's got is the lovely rippling and splashing sound of the river going by all the time, you know. And maybe towards the end of the night, the birds are starting to wake up, or even rather earlier than the end of the night. And the rustling of the wind in the leaves. The Bodhi tree is a very rustly sort of a tree. The leaves make quite a lot of pleasant noise. And then we've got the moon coming down. The moon approaching the horizon. He's gone through the three watches of the night. is looking very big and orange, but the Buddha doesn't see it because he's still got his eyes closed. His eyes have been closed in meditation the whole night. And then the sky starts to lighten in the east. No, he must have been facing east. I'm sorry, I'm getting confused about this, aren't I? He must have been facing east, because what it says is that as the sky starts to lighten, he sees the morning star. So he must have seen the morning star rising. Yeah, so the moon must have gone the other way. Sorry about that. I'm confusing you all with my poor astronomical knowledge about which way he was facing. But no, because this is what it says, and this is the thing that is in the way, the centre of this talk is this point of the morning star, a star very bright, very white, very soft in its light, very beautiful, a single point of light, but shine. Now that the new moon has set, this is the brightest thing in the whole sky. It's the morning star. And in India, I don't know if it still is, but in those days, the morning star was known as the star of healing. The star of healing. Ashadi Taraka in Sanskrit. Ashadi Taraka. And this, as his eyelids part and he sees the star, what the tradition says is that's the moment. If you want to sort of put enlightenment at a particular moment, it's not when he'd fully understood himself. It's not when he developed this compassionate understanding of others. It's not even when he'd finished this process of understanding conditionality in general. It's just that moment when his eyes open and the light comes in and his awareness is presumably of a new kind. Light enters his mind. And this is said to be then the very first object ever grasped by the mind of an enlightened human being, at least on this planet, so they say. So imagine if you were in front of him as his eyes opened and you looked into those calm, deep, very kind eyes, the eyes of a new kind of person, the Buddha. This is Jason's picture of a brass statue of the Buddha. But it does give you a sense, doesn't it? Usually when people do a statue of the Buddha, they try and get that sense of kindness and compassion if they possibly can in the face. So we've seen the Buddha just enlightened, just awakened. And as his eyes open, we see the dark, unfathomable pupils. You know, you've got the huge sky overhead, but you've got the opposite of that. Is looking into somebody's eyes is an amazing thing to do, isn't it? Because what you see is this tiny point of darkness, and you feel that they are somewhere within that darkness of the pupil of the eye. And the interesting thing is that the word that's used for the pupil of the eye is Tara. The same word, Tara, the same word as the word for star. And of course, what you'd see is two little tiny points of light, wouldn't you? Because the star of healing would be reflected. Is this very fanciful? I don't know why, but this sort of imaginative way of looking at it somehow helps me more than, in a way, more than the doctrines, looking at the doctrines somehow. So you'd see the Ashadi Taraka, the star of healing, reflected deeply there. And I think the reason I'm interested in this is because for me, especially around the time of the Enlightenment, everything is significant or could be significant. You know, in the readings we had the Dragon King appearing and some of the other mythological things. And it's all got its significance. Maybe you can work it out, maybe you can't, but somehow it's all significant. I think I'll just recap a little bit over some of those incidents so that you can just reflect, what do they mean? Do they mean anything to you? So we're going back now from the moment of the Enlightenment where we've reached, and we're doing some flashbacks. So if you remember, he'd been trying to practice with a group of five friends. They'd all been doing these very severe self-mortification practices. And he said, this is not working. I'm going to stop. I'm going to eat properly. I'm going to look after myself. I'm no longer going to use pain as a method to move towards Enlightenment. And his friends left him. They said, okay, you've given up, we're off. So he's left completely alone. He's all by himself. And I think this is interesting. And then he remembers, he's probably in confusion, even despair. This didn't work. I don't know what to do. And then he has the memory of his boyhood meditation experience, which Paramahansa was talking about this morning. He remembers sitting under the rose apple tree as a teenager, suddenly just descending into the depths of this really beautiful, calm, blissful meditative state. Very, very equanimous a very pleasurable state, but with no needs. You just sit there. Everything is absolutely fine. And he, ah, that's it. He said, that was pleasure, wasn't it? It was pleasure that was not touched by unskillfulness. It was skillful pleasure. I don't need to go down the route of pain. Pain is useless. There is that route of just pure being a human being and appreciating being a human being. And so he says, okay, I know what I'm doing now. All I need to do is find a nice place to meditate. So he walks around, looks around, and finds the Narrandera River. He finds the grove at Uruvela. He finds the Bodhi tree. He finds a little heap of hay. Right, good. I know what I'm doing. I'm going for it now. The only thing he now needs, of course, is a good square meal. Because he's been doing all this fasting and he's weak. His mind isn't working properly. In fact, he almost drowns when he tries to have a bath in the river because he's so weak. So this is where, to his good fortune, Sujata turns up. And she runs a farm. She has plentiful supplies of sweet milk rice pudding. And she feeds him up. And he's very, very grateful to her. And she also is very grateful to him as well. She said, oh, this is great. I'm really glad to be able to be of service in this way. And she later becomes a disciple of the Buddha. And then there's his resolution. He makes a resolution, sitting under the Bodhi tree, blood may dry up, flesh may wither, but I will not stir from this spot until I've gained complete awakening. And then Mara turns up, and first of all, Mara's insidious questioning, where he tries to raise doubts in the Buddha's mind. So who are you to think that you can gain enlightenment? And that's when he touches the ground. And again, you can see him touching the ground in the image there. Very common in Buddha images, the one downstairs as well. Calling the earth goddess to witness, to say, yes, as I'm the earth, and I've been watching him practice, and I can see he's ready. It's worth him going for this. So she sort of affirms his readiness. And it's interesting, what does that myth mean? What does that imply? What does that mean to you, that sense of touching the ground? In some versions, he strokes himself all over, his whole body. He gives himself a massage, and then reaches and touches the ground, and then the earth goddess emerges from the soil, a bit like a mole coming up out of a molehill, up to her waist, holding a bowl of fruit. And they have
that's
this conversation.
That's what happens when they're really grounded.
Yes. But that's not, Mara hasn't given up. Mara's tried doubt. And then he tries assaulting the Buddha, first of all, with craving through his sons and daughters, trying to distract the Buddha. And then when that doesn't work, he tries using violence. The demon armies that you see in that image, all assaulting the Buddha. And then we've got this tremendous night of deep meditation through the three watches, and then the light of dawn with the beautiful star of healing appearing in the sky. So I mean, we haven't got time to go into a lot of detail about it, but I just think it's worth thinking through some of those things. Being alone when his friends left him, is that significant? What is that? Do we need that? Do we sometimes need aloneness in order to make progress? That memory of his boyhood meditation. Now, he'd been doing lots of meditation for the previous 6 years. So what was it? What was it about his boyhood meditation that was different from the meditation he'd been doing? And it seems that the meditation he'd been doing for those 6 years had been very driven. You know, it was very, very strongly directed. He was trying to get somewhere all the time. He was, you know, had an idea about it. While the boyhood one was this lovely, relaxed, spontaneous kind of meditation. So if you do meditate, then see if you can find that place. And you might even find it through memory. It might be that you can use memory to have a sense of what is it? Can I remember times when I just felt everything was fine? Can I reaccess those times? You know, because I think that's what the Buddha managed to do. And again, it was a theme of this morning's meditation with Paramananda, was the value of memory, the value of looking back, and having a continuous sense of your life. And then there's his choice of where he sat, the beautiful wood with the river and the tree. And I suppose this, I mean, one of the very trite things this makes me think of, it's really good to get out in the countryside sometimes if you are meditating. It's all very well, we try and do it here, you know, but you've got the noise from the pub and the traffic and the dust and all that and the confinement of the city. So, you know, find yourself in the Narrandera River and the Bodhi tree or the equivalent. What's the significance of Sujata? I mean, you know, it's literally significant. He needed some rice pudding, didn't he? Which is very nice. But maybe, again, there's something else to do with that appearance of a woman. The first woman who he has a close relationship with since he left his wife earlier on in the story. It's quite interesting, isn't it? The return of the feminine. It's a very interesting lad, isn't it? Sujata. The Bodhi tree is also, I mean, you know, I've given the whole talk just about the Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree is so significant, isn't it? The sense of the tree. And the legend says that the seed of the Bodhi tree sprouted at the same moment that the Buddha was born. So it's as if the Buddha's life is being mirrored by the growing of a tree. And that is interesting, isn't it, in itself? You know, the sense that that sort of the roots going down, the branches going up, that slow movement of a tree fixed in one place. At the same time, the Buddha, with all his busyness, learning to be a prince and then leaving home and going to lots of teachers, all that sort of stuff. There's a cushion of grass. There's the resolution. Blood may dry up, but I'm not going to move till I've done it, you know. Then there's the Mara's insidious doubt. Inducing questioning and the calling of the earth to witness. A lot of interesting things in there. The assaults of the hosts of Mara, the temptations of Mara's sons and daughters, and what happened in the three watches of the night. So I'm just leaving those hanging in a way, but I think, you know, and many other things I'm sure you could see if you look through all the stories, these amazing little incidents and images and symbols that appear in them. You know, all of them, I'm sure, you know, can be given significance. But the one I want to talk about as a little bit more is this thing of the Star of Healing, the Light of Dawn. It's good not to explain these things too quickly, I think, to let the images touch you deeply and light up your imagination. So I'm just going to stick with the Morning Star, the image of the Morning Star, and say a bit about it from my point of view. Because from a Buddhist point of view, that dawn was the most important moment in the history of the planet, because that is said to be, according to Buddhist tradition at least, the first time in this era that anyone managed to gain enlightenment. Any previous enlightened people have been forgotten about. You remember in the reading I gave, he says, this is the place where many previous sages have sat, what's known as the diamond seat of enlightenment. But they've been forgotten. Their teachings have been lost. So it's really significant when somebody recovers the Dharma in that way. So you think in every dawn, millions of years, the light has swept across the fields, driving the darkness before it. But this was something new. It was a new kind of light that dawned, which was the light of awareness, this light of a mind very sensitive, very compassionate, fully aware. And it seems that there's something about the coming together of a deep understanding and a deep compassion. Both of those elements very prominent in the description of the three watches of the night, which seems to me to characterise enlightenment. And I found that this is probably very well known, but Dante, the great Italian poet, says, the light of the mind is clarified by love. The light of the mind is clarified by love. And that seems to show how there's this, it's all very well being aware, it's all very well being knowledgeable, but there's another element that's required, which is shown in the story of the Buddha and shown also in that quotation from Dante. The light of the mind is clarified by love. And the Dhammapada, talking about this image of light, says, in the day shines the sun, in the night shines the moon, when in his bright armour, the warrior shines. When meditating, shines the sage, but shining all day, and shining all night is the radiance of the Buddha. So this sense of the Buddha shining as a beacon. And in Buddhist tradition, you have often a Buddha, like here, and a Bodhisattva. And a Bodhisattva, which means somebody striving towards Buddhahood, is symbolized by the moon. And very often in these Tibetan sanghas, you'll actually see a moon at one side. And that's the Bodhisattva. And the Buddha is symbolized by the sun. So on this night of the awakening, this full but changeable moon of the Bodhisattva sank down in the west, and the Star of Healing, the moment of enlightenment, rose in the east. And then soon after that, the sun rose, ready to blaze a path across the day, as the Buddha was now ready to blaze this path of compassionate activity, which he did, fortunately for us, he did for 45 years. You know, this is not the end of the story, this is the beginning of the story. So it's really fortunate that he had 45 years to work out how to communicate his experience and how to show other people to do it. So we do have a very sort of well-developed system in Buddhism from that point of view. Now, if you think of a comparison between the moon and the sun, the full moon's radiance is quite strange and unworldly. It's magical. It seems to reflect meditation, the states of mystical meditation that the Buddha-to-be went through on that night, symbolised by the movement of the moon. But the sun's light is very steady. The sun's light drives away all mystery. It drives away all shadows. It's very warm and life-giving. So the moon is the Bodhisattva. The sun is the Buddha. But what I wanted to talk about was the Star of Healing. What is the Star of Healing? It's all very well having these two poles, the moon and the sun, which we're very familiar with in Buddhism. But the Star of Healing appears in the tradition at this critical juncture, the moment of the Enlightenment. It's after the full moon has set. It's before the sun has risen. And the Star of Healing, the morning star, has a pure and soft light. It's the light of somebody's eye, a tiny point of perfect awareness. It's not brash, but it's brighter than all the starry hosts, as it says in the Buddhist poems. It's brighter, in other words, than all the stars. And in fact, just here's a quote from the Buddha, from the old Pali Canon. When the light fades into the dawn, the Star of Healing shines and glows and blazes. And in another occasion, the Buddha compared metta, loving kindness, to the morning star. You may have heard this one, so I'll just read it out for you. Just as in the night, at the time of daybreak, the Star of Healing shines and burns and flashes forth, even so, whatever reasons you've got for doing good for the sake of heavenly rewards, all those reasons are not worth 1/16th part of the metta, the loving kindness, which is the heart's release. Metta, which is the heart's release, alone shines and burns and flashes forth in surpassing them. So it's comparing, you know, the ordinary good deeds that one does to the inner sense of overwhelming love that is represented by metta. That is worth, you know, compared, you know, to all the little stars, the Star of Healing is so much brighter. And that's the comparison that's made in the Atibhutaka. So what is the morning star? Does anyone know what the morning star is?
Venus.
Venus. It's Venus, that's right. So in planetary, as a planet, we're talking about the planet Venus. The most beautiful of all the planets, I would say at least. You know, there's something a bit sort of glittery and metallic about Jupiter and Saturn. But Venus has this lovely, lovely soft light, doesn't it, when you see it? And it is so much brighter than the others as well. And in Indian Buddhism, Venus is used as a simile for brightness, whiteness and purity, but also for constancy. Now, I don't know if anyone here has got enough astronomical knowledge to say why Venus should be a symbol for constancy or consistency.
Because it's always close to the sun.
Well, yeah, that's true, but what does that mean? That has an implication in terms of its path in the sky.
It doesn't go literally before the sun, or it's just after the sun.
Yes, that's right, but in fact, it always follows a consistent path. So the other planets, apart from Mercury, which you usually can't see, the other planets have retrograde motion. If you actually watch the way they go against the stars, that's why they're known as the wanderers, the other planets, aren't they? Because they'll go, and then suddenly go, back again, and then they go. And this is because of the way the Earth is moving around the Sun, and the other planets are moving more slowly. So sometimes, against the background of the stars, as the Earth goes here and the other planet's there, it looks as if it's moved backwards. And then when the Earth comes round again, it starts going in its own direction again. But Venus is not like that. Because Venus is inside the Earth's orbit, it means it always follows a consistent path. It just keeps going on its path against the stars, you know, and you can just follow it. So this is presumably, actually, I mean, I'm assuming this But anyway, this is what the Indian tradition says. It says that Venus is regarded as a symbol of constancy, never deviating in all the seasons. And it's also called, at least in Buddhist tradition, the path of truth. Venus represents the path of truth because of its consistency, of integrity. Now, the word for star is Taraka, as in Asadi Taraka, or Tara. And I imagine that when the Buddha opened his eyes with this new kind of awareness, very difficult to imagine actually, but somehow he opened his eyes and the very first thing he saw was Venus. And how did he experience Venus? Maybe he saw Venus as a radiantly beautiful being, not just a point of light, reflecting his own enlightenment deep in the pupils of his eyes. And you remember I said that the word for pupils is also Tara, the star outside, the star inside. And, of course, Tara, as probably a lot of you know, well, who is Tara? This is Tara. Yes. So, Tara is a bodhisattva or female Buddha. So this is the same word, Tara, star. That's her name. Now, of course, the elaborate mythology of Buddhism, of all the different bodhisattvas and so on, is definitely later, it seems, than the lifetime of the Buddha. So I'm not saying that the Buddha, when he spoke of seeing the morning star, was thinking of Tara with her leg standing down and green in colour and all that kind of thing. Or more likely white Tara, actually, if you think about the colour. But nevertheless, I mean, at least I can't help making that connection between Asadi Taraka, the star of healing, and Tara, the Buddha who represents active compassion. Is that fair? And I'd say probably rather than green Tara, if, again, anyone who knows anything about Tara, if you think about white Tara is surrounded by multiple enveloping shells of rainbow light. And these are the protective lights of health, of skillfulness, or being ethical, and of longevity, of long life. And she shows gleaming, pure white, smiling with infinite kindness. And also she has, white Tara has extra eyes in the palms of her hands and the soles of her feet. She has seven eyes altogether, which means, you know, the symbolism of this is that every action is very aware, is very appropriate, is very enlightened. And Asadi Taraka is also the planet that we call Venus. So, I mean, you can start thinking about the connections with Venus, the feminine deity in the Greek and Roman tradition, Aphrodite in the Greek, Venus in the Roman. And so she is the planet of love. Love, that's right, yes. Sometimes love, sometimes love. The Greek poet Sappho calls her daughter of Zeus, immortal weaver on your gleaming throne. That's the description that he gives of her. But interestingly, the association with love, or erotic love, or whatever, or romantic love, is not there with Venus in the Indian tradition, at least not in Buddhist times. And instead, the association is with healing. So the planet Venus is associated with healing. And this is very interesting. And the word Asadi, remember I said that the star of healing is known as Asadi Taraka. Taraka's star, Asadi, means healing. And it's a word that's used for any medicine, any balm, any refreshment even, is called Asadi. So when the planet Venus was up in the sky, as the morning star, in Indian tradition, that was the time when you should go out into the woods and pick your healing herbs. Because their efficacy was much greater if they were picked under the light of the star of healing. And I'm sure we may be able to work out some logical reason why they're better if they're picked at that time. Or maybe it's complete superstition, I don't know. But it is very interesting that that was the Indian tradition. It may still be, I don't know if it's still a sense with the natural healers there. And that was not just the time to pick them, but you should also make your decoction of the medicinal herbs and drink it down before the sun rises. Now for me, that star represents healing in a specific sense, though. It's not the healing of an injured dog that crawls away into a dark, hidden place to lick his wounds. That's the healing of the night time, you might say, the passive kind of healing, where you've just got to wait. You've got to let nature take its course and let the wound heal, or let the flu get better or whatever. But the star of healing, from a more Buddhist point of view, isn't a passive healing, it's an active healing. It shines on those who wish to actively heal themselves. They understand the need. I've got to go out. I've got to go and find the herbs. I've got to pick them. I've got to make the concoction. I've got to do it. I've actually got to do it myself. And only when really needed as well. Make sure this is really necessary. And so very often the Buddha is described as the great healer, the great physician. It's one of the epithets for the Buddha. But his business wasn't really to be a healer in the sense of somebody who places his hands on you and suddenly you're better. You don't get stories like that in Buddhism, interestingly enough. What you get instead is the Buddha as a physician prescribing a remedy, saying, what I suggest you do is A, B, and C. If you do that, you'll get better. But it's up to you. You've got to do it yourself. So there's that very strong sense of the healing process being an active one. I don't just mean medical healing. I mean the healing that we need in many other ways, don't we? The mental healing, the emotional healing that we need, the progress along the path that we need. And so what the Buddha does is to diagnose the illness. And you probably know that it's often said that the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism are based on a traditional medical formula, mirroring the doctor's procedure. The doctor says, what is the illness? What's the cause of the illness? Can the illness be cured? What is the process of cure? Or maybe not more than can it be cured, but what does the healed situation, what does the well person look like? And so when the Buddha looked at the illness that he felt people were subjected to, as in that reading I gave earlier, he says the illness is intense frustration. The illness is lack. It's dukkha. It's the being something wrong with life. That's his diagnosis of the illness. What's the cause? The cause is a yearning for security, a yearning for an identity which nothing can threaten. So he saw the cause in that way. And he said, can it be cured? What's a cure like? Yes, it's cured when you wake up, when you see things as they really are, when the star of healing gleams in your eyes. So the fully healed condition is enlightenment itself. That's the third noble truth. And then how do you get healed? The fourth noble truth. This is by the remedy prescribed by the great physician, the herbs that you must gather yourself, you must take them yourself under the light of the star of healing. So you get healed by the path. All the stages of the Buddhist path, that's the idea. The medicine is the Dharma itself. And that path, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with many ways of talking about the path, but you need to start out by living with kindness, the ethical phase. You need to create bright mental states, the meditation phase. And as a result of this, you need to become more aware, letting yourself get out of the way. Ethics, meditation, wisdom. These are the medicines. These is the elixir. So in the end, the Buddha is described as the great physician. And he said he felt the world needs healing, and he felt they've got to heal themselves. But I can help. So to see how the whole world is healed, I just want to go back to the moonlight of that magical night, the night of the enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And I want to go back to something that the Buddha said later when he tried to describe what his experience had been like, and he used almost like a dream image to describe it. Rather than, you know, sometimes he'd say, yes, in the first watch of the night, I looked back and understood myself. In the second look of the night, I developed compassion for others. In the third watch of the night, I understood conditioning and reproduction. Sometimes he described it in that very, you might call, rational, careful way. But he also described it in terms of an image, and this is the image. I'll just read out the quote. This is when he's describing his enlightenment. He says, then the thought came to me, I have won to the path of enlightenment. And there arose in me a vision into things not before called to mind. Knowledge arose, insight arose, wisdom arose, light arose. Just as if a man wandering through a forest along a mountain height should come upon an ancient path an ancient track traversed by men of former days. And he should proceed along it, and going along it, he should see an ancient city, an ancient royal domain wherein dwelt men of former days, a ruined city having gardens and groves and pools with stout walls around it, a delightful spot. And suppose that that man should tell of his find to the prince or the royal minister of that region, saying, "Pardon, sire, I would have you know that as I fared through the forest, through the mountain height, I came upon an ancient path, an ancient road, traversed by men of former days. And I've been along it, and going along it, I've seen an ancient city. Sire, restore that city." And suppose that the prince or the royal minister should restore that city, so the city should thereafter become prosperous and flourishing, populous, teeming with folk, reaching growth and increase. Even so, I have seen an ancient path. I've seen an ancient road traversed by the perfectly enlightened ones of former times. So that's what I think of. I think it's a really rich image, don't you? So I think of the Buddha imagining himself before his enlightenment, he was stumbling along, lost in the forest, not knowing where he was going, maybe wandering in the deep night shadows, and then stumbling, you sort of stub your toe against something, and it looks like a paving stone. You think, sort of, oh my goodness, there's another one, you know, in the undergrowth. It's some sort of an old road, isn't it? Imagine how exciting that would be in the darkness of the forest. You couldn't resist it, could you? You'd have to follow that road, see where it led you to, like an old Roman road in the English countryside. And I think of that, when I think of that, I contact the feeling of wandering around in my own life, sometimes thinking I'm lost in a forest wilderness, sometimes thinking I know full well what I'm doing, which I probably don't, and then feeling the relief of finding a path, you know, finding the path of the Dharma. Ancient trackway, very ancient trackway, overgrown in places, some bits of it almost forgotten, but a real path to follow. And then the sense of the city, the old city at the end. And I think of that ruined city in the moonlight, the stones, the old temples, paved streets worn by wheels of centuries ago, trees pushing through the old walls, and the feeling of all the life that once must have lived in that city. And I think of the city as being the city of the Sangha, of the Buddhist community. So the Buddha didn't just sit there in the moonlight, dreaming, musing on his past. He wanted to restore the city. He'd found not just a path, he'd found a city. He wanted to restore the city. But isn't it interesting in the story that it's not the traveller who restores the city, it's the prince, or the ruler, or the government, if you like. In other words, it's not somebody, well, could it? You can't restore a city by yourself. So there's something about something bigger being marshalled. The Buddha couldn't actually create Buddhism himself. He had to do it cooperatively. It took thousands of people, and still is taking thousands of people, to make Buddhism actually happen. And those people are us, basically. You can't leave it to anyone else. If you're interested in Buddhism, if you're interested in it, then it's by practicing Buddhism that you restore the ancient city. That's, for me at least, I don't know, you might have your own interpretation, but for me at least, that's what that image means. So the Buddha knew he couldn't do it alone, so he went back away from the beautiful spot. He had a lovely spot, he could have stayed there for years if he wanted to. He had the rice pudding, you know, he wasn't even starving. But he went back into the world, he went back into his own contemporary world, as in the traveller in the vision went back to talk to the government. The Buddha marshalled all his powers, all his friends, to return to the city with a great company of builders and masons, architects, gardeners, decorators and so on. And first of all, of course, you've got to open up the path. You've got to open up the old trackway to the city of enlightenment. And back and forth they went up and down the track, keeping it clear, keeping it open, carrying the materials to build a new city, a city even greater than the ancient one. And they left the moonlight and they let the star of healing rise and do its magic work, and they travelled and worked into the bright day, trying to build up a beautiful world. So I think that's what this dream that the Buddha had, or vision the Buddha had of the ancient city, is saying. It's not enough just to walk up and down on your own little favourite bit of the ancient road. If you really want to make a difference in the world, there needs to be a joining together, I think, to restore those ruins. In later Buddhism, it was known as building the Buddha land. Building the Buddha land was the term used for this process that the Sangha is collectively engaged in. No one person can do it. It's all very well having wonderful charismatic lamas or something, but actually it's to do with ordinary people actually working on themselves and communicating, cooperating with each other. The city of Buddhism is always decaying. It's always going to crumble. It's not a museum piece. You can't just let it be there and occasionally slap on a bit of plaster. It actually needs to be rebuilt, to be constantly restored, I think. And in fact, one of the sutras says that the new Pure Land is only built of living beings. It's not built of bricks and mortar. It's built of living beings. In other words, it's only us that can restore the city. And the city is us. We are the buildings of that city. It's not something external. So when the Buddha's eyes opened on the Star of Healing on that first Buddha day, about 2,500 years ago, the whole world changed because of what one person had achieved, and something new started. But I think only you and I can actually carry on what started. And I hope we won't leave the City of Enlightenment in its ruined state, but build it up in cooperation with each other. And I think of that when I think of our new centre. You know, in September or October, we'll be moving down the road, a big new centre. And of course, the building is important, but we can get professionals in to do that. But really, it's living beings. It's people. That's what's going to make the difference there. It's going to be a bit of a wrench, you know, to leave the beloved old ruined centre and move to the new one. But it will have better facilities down there, you know. So I hope you can cope with that. The sadness, the loss, the grief of moving away from a place where we've been for 22 years into a new place. But be involved if you want to be. And I hope there'll be lots and lots of ways that people can be involved. Having a new building is great, but Sangha needs creating, Sangha needs cherishing. And maybe you can start by thinking through that story, thinking through the process of the Buddha's enlightenment, the different symbols. Some of them may speak to you, some of them may not, but some of them may say something to you. You know, oh, that tells me something about what I need to do. Opening our eyes, letting in a little gleam of the Star of Healing, and also seeing that star in the pupils of the eyes of people. You know, if you're looking for something, there's always a gleam, isn't there, if you look into somebody's eyes, into the taras in their eyes. A light of the mind clarified by love. So I love that velvety darkness before dawn. That's something which I still like, actually, wandering around the darkness. But I realised that the reason I like it is because it is actually illuminated. It's illuminated not by the light, even the moonlight. It's illuminated by my own awareness. I mean, I wouldn't particularly like it if I wasn't aware. So it's that light of awareness that is really important. And I love that sense of awareness, probing its boundaries, pushing it further. Awareness reaching out, reaching into my own depths, reaching to other people as well. That's all that matters, I think. So that's what I'm hoping we can do, sort of open our eyes to that gleam of the Star of Healing and to celebrate Buddha Day in that manner. So I'll stop there.